British Public Radio. Food and Drink.
Hello and welcome to the UK Wine Show. My name's Chris Scott, and on this week's show, we're talking with Hugo Rose. He's the head of trading at Culliver Street, based in Colchester. They're a wine investment company. Hugo is a master of wine, and he is also chairman of the brand new, spanking new Wine Investment Association. Now, the show's going to be quite a short one. I know you've probably missed me, and I hope you all had a great Christmas and a fantastic New Year. I had a pretty good Christmas and New Year. Main down point was that Jane has got very ill. Sadly, she's landed up with pneumonia and is currently in the intensive care unit at Kingston Hospital, so she's not particularly well at all. So the show this week is going to be mainly the interview and the news, and it's all going to be me. You know, I know you probably all miss her already, but so do I, and so do our kids. So let's crack on with the show, and we're going to start off this week with the news. And award-winning English winery goes into administration. One of England's most prominent vineyards has announced that they are going into administration this week. Wickham Vineyards had three of their wines served at the lunch attended by the Queen and Duke of Edinburgh to mark the Queen's Diamond Jubilee in London last year. The vineyard in Hampshire has won several awards for its Special Reserve A Red 2006, Special Reserve Fumé Non-Vintage, and Vintage Selection Dry Non-Vintage. And it's won medals or commendations in Decanter World of Wine 2009. Wickham was established in Hampshire in 1984 and filed for bankruptcy just before Christmas with a loss of more than 20 jobs. Although it's understood that the allied business, Vineyard Restaurants and Wineshare, will continue to trade. Now, you may recall back in December 2009, Wickham purchased 15 First Quench stores when First Quench went into administration themselves. And while I'm not certain of this, I can imagine that the costs in terms of cash flow of taking over and running such a large set of stores in one hit may have put significant pressure on the business. Retail is a tough business, and if the winery is sold off, I hope the business can rise again. And you may recall back in August 2010, we interviewed Joe Nowak on the Wine Show about Wickham, and our hopes and prayers go with her and the rest of the team at Wickham, and I hope some of them manage to keep their jobs, or at least when the business is sold on. Now, the next story is all about Australia, and Australia's fires destroy wineries and risk the 2013 vintage. As wildfires sweep Australia, several vineyards are on red alert. Already, Yaxley Estate Vineyards in Tasmania has lost three quarters of its vines. With 5 hectares of organic certified vineyard, predominantly Pinot Gris and Pinot Noir, Yaxley told the Mercury that the fires had destroyed the best crop they'd ever had. Meanwhile, dozens of firefighters are already battling to keep a fire under control in Seven Hills area of Clare Valley. With temperatures in Adelaide forecast hit 44 degrees on Friday, with the heatwave expected to last more than a week. The Clare Valley blaze, which has so far remained within the fire control lines, is burning across wooded slopes overlooking vineyards near Seven Hill. To date, no damage of vines or winery has been reported. In South Australia, the State County Fire Service said that fire danger for vineyard areas including Kangaroo Island and Mount Lofty Ranges has rated as catastrophic for Saturday, with several areas facing extreme or severe risk. Now, I've got family living in Queensland, and when my dad built his house, he's a builder by trade, he had masses of planning restrictions on what he could do and how he could build to help the building survive a fire, which where he lives in slightly inland Queensland can get very, very hot. But it isn't just the risk the winery is burning down that's the problem. Smoke can damage grapes and certainly put off flavours into the wines. In the past, all sorts of things have been done to try and remove nasty flavours caused by smoke damage. So even vineyards that survived the fire may find that their crop is severely damaged and they may produce a poor quality wine. From my understanding, the rain that broke the 2009 vintage may have been part of the problem with this year's fires. With lush vegetation bursting forth after the drought broke, that vegetation is now tinder dry and the current heat wave is ready to send it up in smoke. Not good if you're an Australian winemaker, especially after they've just had a couple of years where things have been going okay for them in Australia to get hit by a bunch of fires. It's sad. It's tough. It's tough business. And the last story this week, Decanter raises conflict of interest with Robert Parker's wine advocate investor. Decanters learned of a potential conflict of interest with a new buyer of Robert Parker's Wine Advocate. Su Hu Kong Ping, the Malaysian businessman who is the main shareholder in the syndicate that bought the Wine Advocate, still has close ties to the fine wine retailer Hermitage Wines, company founded. His wife is a senior director of Hermitage Wine, and she is listed as a majority shareholder of the company. Su Hu Kong Ping left the company in November. So far, Wine Advocate and Robert Parker have declined to comment. Now, the story here was from late December, just before we shut down for Christmas, but it does look as if Robert Parker's Wine Advocate may have lost some of its much-trumpeted independence. And Decanter have been given a bashing by Robert in the past about their independence for running ads for wine companies, I think are probably jumping with joy with the chance of getting some back. Okay, that ends the news. Now let's crack on with the interview. And as I said at the top of the show, we're interviewing Hugo Rose. He is a master of wine and he's head trader at Culver Street Wines in Colchester. Hugo is also the chairman of the new Wine Investment Association. And we're going to be talking to him about the Wine Investment Association. How impartial are they? Whether they'll do a good job or not? We'll let you form that own opinion, but I ask him some pretty tough questions, and he's answered them, and you see if he's answered them to your level of satisfaction. Just be a bit careful, though. I refer to this thing called the PCC, and that stands for the Press Complaints Commission. It was also an industry-managed body, which was so weak, it's been badly discredited. So bear that in mind when we're talking about comparisons between the Wine Investment Association and the PCC.
It is something that is widely recognized that companies that store wine for their customers, if they fail for any reason, either through market circumstances or indeed mismanagement, sometimes worse, if the company hasn't obeyed certain processes and procedures, it is possible for the owner of wine not to receive their wine if the company goes bust.
What? How would that be? What? Give me an example.
So the company is the really most of the major wine merchants store wines for their customers. The wine is in bond. You can't do that yourself. So you require a company to provide the umbrella cellarage account for you. So they're looking after your wine. They're custodians of your wine. And if they haven't been careful to ensure that they have passed the title to that wine to you, and there are processes and procedures to do that. If that company gets into trouble and ultimately falls into administration, your wine is seen as an asset of the company, not as an asset that you own. And so instead of receiving your wine at that point, you find that you're an unsecured creditor.
And you're just in the queue to get a fraction
of it. And you may get 100% of your wine back with great relief. You may get 50 pence in the pound. You may get close to zero.
So it's not about trying to protect the consumer so far as from fraudulent behavior. It's more about trying to make sure that the people who are a part of the association have systems in place to ensure that if something goes wrong, it's okay.
Well, there is a link between the two. That is to say, a company that is adopting the right procedures, sound procedures and policies with regard to custody of customers' wines, even if there was fraudulent practice, following the code of practice would limit the risk of damage.
No, I was thinking more along the lines of some unscrupulous individuals in a boiler room just selling fictitious wine and never anticipating.
Well, I think it's unlikely that companies who have fraudulent objectives would want to join our association, and because an important plank of our program is what we call a compliance audit, where in order to become a member, they have to open up certain aspects of their books to external auditors to show that where a case is sold, a case actually exists. That is a filter that would I think a fraudulent company would not want to put itself through that filter.
Okay, I presume then that some companies, and I've heard this, you know, before On Premier even kicks off, sometimes you get people offering cases of wine that are not even available for sale at the moment. So that sort of thing couldn't occur under WLIA.
You're absolutely right to point out that the On Premier contract is a potential weak link. And that is where a lot of the fraud occurs, that either the wine was not actually ordered, we consider that fraudulent, the practitioners might say it's short selling, But I think that's wishful thinking on their part.
So you wouldn't support short selling as in the WIA?
Strictly speaking, in a financial sense, you have to have borrowed in order to sell short. I have heard the argument that a company has sold a case of wine, has not bought it, but intends to buy it later on. So that's a sort of form of short selling. We consider that unscrupulous, whatever happens. When you buy a Caisson Primeur, you don't own it on the day you bought it. No. You own the right to have it delivered to you 2 years down the line. It doesn't exist on the day you bought it. So title can't pass until it's physically available and in this country. So there is a confidence gap, if you like, and it's not possible to fill that entirely. What we do is, through our processes, the company has to show, the member has to show that that case has been ordered and there is a documented trail between sale to the customer backwards right up to placing the order for that wine.
And who is it up to? Is it up to, because on premier is fraughtfully difficult with negotiants and all sorts of people in between the chateau and ultimately the trader who's selling the wine to you or I. Is it all backed up all the way to the chateau?
No, the chateau has no relationship with even the merchant in this country. And so they have no obligation to us at all. And that's true for a small trader or the largest wine company in the UK. They have no direct relationship with the chateau. The chateau has no obligation to them. The merchant in this country has a contract with a merchant in France.
Okay.
The merchant in France has a contract with the chateau.
Yep.
So the chateau doesn't know who in this country has bought its wine. I won't say it doesn't care, it'll be wrong to say that. But they are not liable for a breakdown in that contractual relationship in the first instance.
No. But when you're doing an audit trail back, you would check that the seller of the wine or the seller of the on-premier wine would have a contract with the merchant in France.
The requirement is that they've placed a legitimate order which has been accepted by a merchant in France.
Okay.
And it can't go further back than that.
Okay, so you don't check because the merchant's fraudulent, it's just that they've placed an order.
No, I won't say it's not necessary to do that. I don't know how we would do that, but I don't think it adds protection because there's a contract. Contract is built up between the merchant and its customer, and our job through the audit process is to make sure that's a valid contract.
Okay.
That it's substantiated with a valid purchase. It is true that things can go wrong. Actually, there could be a fire at the chateau, which might
wipe everything out.
Prevent delivery of that wine. And we can't legislate against that. So there are limits to what our powers, if you like. And that applies not just to the Wine Investment Association's powers of audit, but the legal process stops with the next one in the chain.
You mentioned that it's got an independent audit. We're in the offices of Mazars at the moment, very salubrious that they are on Tower Bridge. They're the auditors for this that you said were going to do the audit trail checking inside the company.
Yes, for us this is groundbreaking to require members to undertake an external audit of its processes. We call it a compliance audit, as distinct from a full financial or a company audit. A compliance audit to show that their processes hold water. Because you look at the evidence of companies that have failed, all of them have had processes that are not watertight, and in some cases are downright deficient.
It's easy for a small company trying to get going to not have the processes in place because it takes time to build processes.
Well, that's right. I mean, you do need to have, even if you're a small company, to some extent you have to have a big company mentality when you are responsible for customers' stock. It's almost like a bank who is responsible for its clients' money. We are responsible. We are entrusted with the safekeeping of our clients' wine.
So let me understand the process. I'm a customer. I come up to Culver Street and I say, I want to buy some wine on Premier or just wherever, really. I'm not too worried about that. I give you a wad of cash because you want money up front usually. You hold on to that money until the wine's ready for delivery to you and then you pay the merchant in France. Does that money go into an escrow account? Is that required or does it just go into your general funds? Because that's where a lot of businesses often have problems. You know, the travel agency is a worst one for that until they made sure that everybody had to go into escrow accounts.
An escrow account would be very costly. I can see the potential advantages. It's not a practice that any wine merchant I know employs. So the payment does go into our commercial account. It goes into the bank account. Obviously, we are very concerned to pay our suppliers on time, and there are clear credit terms, whether it's 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, to pay for the on-premier orders. So they are paid up long before the wine comes for delivery.
Okay, so the money just comes into an account, and hopefully they've got enough money when they go to pay the bills.
Yeah, I mean, the bills are paid within 3 months of the launch, the sale of the on-premier. So it's not as though it's a two-year lag before that we're holding onto somebody's money for 2 years. It goes into our account, and the stage payments agreed with the négociants, if we're talking about France, and usually 30, 60, 90 days, or 60 days, 120 days is typical for the payment process.
And can you impose fines or anything? What is the strongest medicine you can dish out?
Well, we're not a fining organization. Let us say a company is a member. If they're not a member, by the way, we have no sanctions against them. We can't adjudicate or legislate for, shall we say, the bad boys of the industry. Our job is to identify the good guys and encourage them to join the association, albeit having to jump up to a certain height to do that. If they are a member and are then in breach of the code, they then are responsible for following the code of practice. And obeying the code of practice. So we move into the second stage now. Now that they've passed the compliance audit hurdle, they are now into the world of the code of practice. They have to adhere to the tenets of the code. And this is where we have the potential to not to penalize, but to deliver sanctions against those companies where a complaint is made against them that they are in breach of the code. And that's where we now move on to our independent panel, who will sit in judgment, who will adjudicate on complaints. So complaints will normally come from customers of those companies. And it might be, I was given the wrong advice. I was told that this was a long-term investment, and it turns out it's a short-term. It might be that I was sold the 05 vintage of Léa-Villescas, and my stock record shows it's the 04. And I don't consider that they're the same as each other. They're not of equal merit. The merchant insists that I agreed to buy the 04. I'm pretty sure I agreed to buy the 05. I've got the paperwork to prove it. They won't see my argument. And so they may then make a complaint to the association because one of our members, they believe, is in breach of the code.
Yep.
They're not meeting a specific clause in the code. Normally, we will ask the member what they think about this first. They have a right of reply, effectively. We'll pass it back to the member in the first instance. We're not going to come down. We're not going to throw the full weight of the law until it's clear that there's not going to be a meeting of the minds. So if the member is unable to satisfy the complaint, the complainant, then the complaint is then sent to the independent panel, who will sit in judgment on that complaint. And they have a range of sanctions open to them, from a requirement that certain changes are made, or escalating up to a publication of the adjudication, in other words, naming and shaming, but still keeping the member on board, and obviously a requirement to remedy the complaint, and ultimately the sanction is expulsion.
Okay. And who appoints this panel? How's the panel made up?
We recognize that credibility required that it wasn't merchants sitting in judgment on merchants.
No, that was what the PCC did. So you can't have that.
Well, it is problematic, shall we say. I mean, in some instances, it might be right. We've decided that it is inappropriate and we need a degree of impartiality. We are a trade-led organization, so the only way we can do that is to bring people in from the outside. So we are right now recruiting lawyers, compliance professionals, accountants. We need to have four sitting on the panel. We're probably going to have to recruit six in order to do that. We'll then lodge their details with our lawyers so that it's a good question you've raised. The panel, the identity of the panel needs to remain anonymous. We could be exposing them to reputational risk if their names were in the ether.
Who appoints them?
Well, we have a nominations committee right now. Of course, it's overlaps with the board of directors because we're as yet a small group. But the nominations committee will have formal responsibility to appoint and therefore to appoint wisely.
And on the board itself or in the panel, is there anybody that represents the consumer per se? I know it's an industry body, but do you have any consumer advocates there, like Which or any sort of organization?
I think we're still at an early stage. Right now, our feeling is that it should be a professional adjudication. And I think we'll take a view on that. I mean, we're now entering a consultation process, and if we get a loud noise that says you must have somebody who has particular skills in consumer rights, for example, then we'll listen to that. I think the jury is slightly open on that, but the key principle is independence of the wine industry. People who understand the issues, because they're professional in that area, but they have nothing to do with anyone in the industry whose cases they might be adjudicating on.
What about the board itself? Is it all just wine people, or is there any independent people on the board?
You're looking at a quarter of it right now. the board right now is four practitioners from the wine industry. This is self-regulation. It's a very important tenet for us that it's an industry-led organization. I mean, there is scope down the line for hypothetically non-executive directors, but I think we're some way away from that yet.
Hope you enjoyed that interview. I'm going to finish the second part. There's a shorter interview just to finish this up next week, and then we're on to some other topics. In fact, at the beginning of the week, before Jane went into hospital, I was down talking to Octavian. I've been down talking to Octavian, who are one of the largest fine wine storage companies. They store fine wines in the UK. And I've also done an interview with a retailer of very old wines. And we're going to be talking about some of the old wines that are really good to drink and which ones to age and which ones to keep, etc. Quite an interesting show, those two. Anyway, just to finish up this week's show, we have our quote, and this week's quote is from Charles Dickens. Probably not the best time given the fires in Australia, but fan the flames of a hilarity with a wing of friendship and pass the rosé wine. Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a British Public Radio presentation in association with the wine tasting company 3050. For more, go to 3050.co.uk.